You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to New Books in Science Fiction and Fantasy. This is your host, Dan Nexon. In today's podcast, I talk with Madeline Ashby about her debut novel, VN. Madeline is a strategic foresight consultant in Toronto. She holds a master's in manga and anime and writes on related subjects at IO9, Boing Boing, and Tor.com. VN is the story of Amy Peterson, a 5-year-old self-replicating android who, in the blink of an eye, is forced to give up her life as a kindergartner and become a fugitive on the run with forces that want to destroy her hot on her heels. To jaded science fiction fans, this may not sound like much, but what emerges is a philosophical and political tour de force that imagines what it would be like for androids if they were in fact forced to live under Asimov's laws of robotics. Hi, this is Dan Nexon, and today I'm talking with Madeline Ashby. Madeline, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Thank you so much for coming on the podcast today.
Thank you for having me.
So I always start out, and it's probably getting boring by now, by asking not the information that I'm going to hear, but the question, by asking our authors to tell us a little bit about yourself.
That's a hard thing to answer, given that I'm never sure which you know part of me people would actually like to know about. My name is Madeline Ashby. I'm a science fiction writer and a strategic foresight consultant. I have 2 master's degrees. I speak a smattering of several languages, none of them particularly well. I live in Toronto. I used to live in the United States. I went to Seattle University, which is a Jesuit school, which is an odd place for a science fiction writer sometimes. And now I'm here, and I have a book out called VN, which is Little V, Big N.
Which is what I hope we're going to be talking about for most of the interview, which is a really terrific book, and I enjoyed it a lot. Before we get a little bit into it, though, there are some aspects of your background that I thought might be of particular interest, which certainly I found interesting. So you say that being at a small Jesuit institution was not necessarily the most obvious place for a science fiction writer. That implies to me that you always knew you wanted to be a science fiction writer or were writing science fiction back in college. Is that right?
I had always known that I wanted to be a writer. I learned that I wanted to be a science fiction writer in college. I was doing an honors project and a departmental honors thesis on science fiction. And that was kind of when I learned that it was what I wanted to do.
So you have a background in science fiction studies then?
A little bit. I mean, I devoted, most of 1 year to it, to, specifically to the works of Ursula K. Le Guin, but I did a lot of background reading. That's when I read my Heinlein. I read Extra Asimov during that time. I read a lot of Frank Herbert. I read a lot of, Philip Jose Farmer. things like that to sort of train me up even more than I already had been. And really after meeting Ursula when in person that I kind of decided that this is what I wanted to do.
And then it also, you have a significant web trail, as it were.
I do, yes.
And you've written for a number of very prominent outlets that are either directly within or engaged with the science fiction community. Do you want to
yes.
tell us a little bit about that?
Well, I've written for Boing Boing, for .com, Creators Project, World Changing. My short fiction has appeared in Flurb, which is Rudy Rucker's magazine, Nature, The Nature, which is what the second thing people always ask. Nature? Like the science journal? Yes, that Nature.
So you have an exciting new novel out called VN. We've mentioned that before. Maybe you could tell us a bit about the story, what kinds of basics our listeners will need to know to understand what it's about.
Well, VN is the story of Amy Peterson, who is a 5-year-old self-replicating humanoid robot. She lives with her previous iteration, her mother, Charlotte, and her organic father, Jack, her human dad. And they live together in Oakland, California, in a very idyllic kind of setup in their own way. They're sort of a mixed organic synthetic family. And they all of that is shattered when Amy's grandmother, Portia, shows up and starts immediately beating on Amy's mom at kindergarten graduation. And Amy wastes no time when this happens and runs up on stage and eats her grandmother. And after eating her, she A, gains in mass proportionate to what she's just consumed, and B, then carries Portia as a little partition on her sort of mental drive space. And has to deal with Portia fighting for control of her own body. And they sort of share a journey together, discovering things about Amy's family and about what life is really like for other VN who don't have the same kind of privileges that Amy does.
So this is a fairly elaborate near future world. And maybe it would be helpful for you to tell us a little bit more about, you know, what VNs are and what the world building in the story involves.
Well, VN are they are robots, but they're not necessarily robots in the traditional sense of the term. They're the machines that build them, the machines that they are constructed of, the parts that make them are all at the nanoscale. They're all very small. So part of what makes them more passable for human or more enjoyably human is the fact that they are, you know, all of those little structures that help their faces move and help their speech sound right and help them process information and so on. All of those happen at something that is closer to the scale of the human cell. They are the results of a big international megachurch having tithed for them in the event of the rapture. They wanted to leave behind some sort of helpmeets or companions for those who literally got left behind in the presumed rapture. And then when the church hit financial troubles due to a big, 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 big class action lawsuit, they had to quickly sell a lot of the patents and API for all of these robots. And thus this is why, despite the fact that the rapture has not occurred, they are walking around out and about free. So they were initially programmed to be, you know, helpers and sort of, you know, they were designed to sort of sop up the urges of everybody that God might not like. or that this church thought that God might not like, and now they're just out and about free. And the consequence of that is that they love humans unconditionally. One character close to the end of the book says that you must love us like God loves us, and that's one of the themes running throughout the book.
Yeah, so just for clarification, how far in the future is, I mean, VN's not, you know, I'm not, you know, not a date.
I'm not sure, really. Like, I suppose that's a bad answer. I would say that there's an earthquake that that a lot of the plot sort of revolves around that should be happening any day now, actually, and stuff. But which I postulated might happen within the next 50 years or so.
So we have a sort of environment that is recognizably our own, but altered in many subtle and then not so subtle ways by the impact of the spread of these von Neumann machines, the VN, through the environment. I thought that was, you did a really nice job of creating that sense of both familiar and unfamiliar throughout the book.
Oh, thank you.
Just as your protagonist is moving through a landscape which to her is familiar and yet increasingly unfamiliar. We could get into some issues of the plot, and that might be fun to do in a bit, but there's obviously a lot thematically going on in the book. One of the things that we often see in novels that involve other forms of life, particularly robot life, and this goes all the way back to the creation of the first sort of the very origins of the robot story, right, where robots are a proxy for class issues, is the use of artificial intelligence robots to explore themes that we often explore through themes of class, race, and gender, right? But to do so in a way which is distinctive or slanted or infused with a fantastical or science fictional element. And I was curious whether you set out to do that or whether there were particular kinds of ideas that you thought you were exploring in VN through that trope.
I think that I wanted to talk about the commodification of the human being in general. I think that we commodify people, we reify human beings more often than not, and we sort of attach monetary and other values to human beings in the same way that we attach value to objects. That's what objectification means, right? When we talk about objectifying women or men or objectifying certain parts of their bodies or things like that, you know, you're turning a person into a thing that can be bought. And that's what intrigued me about writing about VN and writing about sort of humanoid robots in general, is you're talking about a thinking, feeling, sentient organism that you buy and sell. And that, I think that kind of makes people really, really uncomfortable in that they realize that we buy and sell human beings every single day. And sometimes that happens in illegal contexts, like things like human trafficking and so on. And other times it happens, you know, just in the way that employees are treated by bad organizations, by bad companies, or unfair companies. So I think that that's what intrigued me about the idea, was, you know, the possibility of talking about humans as things to be bought and sold.
That's really interesting. One of the things that I really liked about the book was that often when these attempts kind of collapse under their own weight, right? That they become too obvious and too trite. And I didn't feel at any time that VN did that. In fact, it was successful enough that I wanted you to clarify what particular kinds of ideas that you were working through. And one of the reasons I think it succeeds well is because it maintains a certain kind of ambiguity or ambivalence about a lot of the issues that it raises. Was that a deliberate move on your part?
Yeah, I mean, I thought that there was enough room in the world for some nuance and for some understanding of why people would want to be in relationships with VN in a non-predatory way. There are a lot of good people who are in relationships with VN. Many of them are at the end of their personal romantic line. Like, they have just had enough with relationships with their fellow human beings, but often that's earned. You know, they've just been betrayed so many times, or they've been hurt, or they have a past history that a lot of people can't get behind or something like that. And so they turn to this sort of unconditionally loving organism or machine. And on the other hand, there are people who use these unconditionally loving sort of bio machines to indulge in their sort of darkest desires and so on. So I thought that there was room for both ends of the spectrum there. And I wanted to be understanding of all of the characters all at once. Like it's really hard, especially because writing Amy and writing Portia at the same time, like, you have to be with both of them and you have to believe both of them at the same time when you're writing them. And Amy has had a really good experience of living with a human being and being educated by them and playing with them and so on. For the most part, she's had a pretty good experience. And whereas her grandmother, Portia, has had a really phenomenally terrible experience sometimes. And she's, and more to the point, she just has no respect for humanity, no regard for humanity whatsoever. And so you have to really believe both of those women at the same time. You have to believe in what they're saying, even when they contradict each other.
And I think one of the things that you do well is make both of their reactions plausible consequences, not only of their history, but of the system in which they're embedded, which is, I think, it's easy to wind up sort of giving disparate psychological explanations for human behavior, but to see both of them as having responded to a flawed system of how VN are integrated or not integrated or used or treated with respect, I think is a more complicated kind of narrative endeavor. One of the things that struck me, or that I, you know, I think any kind of book like this raises comparisons with, and you've already, some of the names you've already mentioned when you talked about your years studying science fiction, right? That there are real shades of play on Asimov. This book, and then also it bears resemblances to some of Le Guin's writings about using science fiction to deal with themes of commodification, objectification, gender, race, etc.
Yeah.
So I was wondering how you that is that a conscious you know, I guess it's unavoidable, right, that you would engage with these figures, but what kinds of ways do you see yourself as in dialogue with them?
I definitely like Le Guin's writing a lot better than I like Asimov's writing. I would rather be compared to her. I feel that when I'm reading Asimov, I love the ideas, and I often just cannot stand the execution. I find it occasionally pretty dry and kind of, you know, it doesn't, that dialogue is not how humans talk. and stuff. So I try to write more naturalistically in the same way that Le Guin does. Le Guin's big literary hero is actually Virginia Woolf, which I think people don't, who haven't really studied her, don't necessarily know. And when you know that, a lot of her writing makes a lot more sense in terms of how she goes about things like exposition and sharing ideas and how she illustrates the social realities of her imaginary world. And so I always just try to keep her in mind, keep Le Guin in mind, who is also keeping Wolf in mind. I like Le Guin better than I like Wolf, but that's just me. So it's whether or not I'm in dialogue with these writers, I think everybody is always, whenever you're writing a story that shares so many themes and so many ideas with so many other works that have gone before you, you are sort of always already engaged in an if then con, or not an if, an old new contract, right? You're always establishing what you always have to lay down what you know about a theme or a genre or what have you, and then you add to it in your own way. I'm not trying to, you know, when I wrote VN, I was not trying to say like, oh, and by the way, Isaac Asimov is wrong or something. That's, you know, I'm not out there to like prove anybody wrong or right or stand inside anybody's camp. It's just that these were issues that I hadn't seen explored, aside from maybe in things like anime, actually. I found that the more nuanced descriptions of what and depictions of what life as a consumer object would be like were actually sort of better depicted by things like Ghost in the Shell standalone complex, the animated television series that's related to the longstanding Ghost in the Shell media property. There are episodes of that series that deal so succinctly and so painfully with what it is to be a thing that is bought, that I was just blown away. And it surprised me that, like, you know, the longstanding examples of robot fiction in our genre really don't discuss what it feels like to have that happen. It's always about, you know, can we tell if it's a robot or not?
And then endless debates about sentience. And you actually have a wonderful, I don't know if it's a throwaway line that kind of, I thought was a kind of signpost of, you know, we're not going to get stuck in philosophical debates about that, in the book. But I did think, I mean, when I asked you about Asimov and Le Guin, my real purpose was to sort of see, I read some of what's happening in VN as if you approached the kinds of tropes that Asimov lays out, you know, particularly what's now become a cliche, the three laws of robotics. Mm-hmm. And you thought about with a kind of, you know, a more critical perspective, what would it actually mean for the sentient entities on which those laws were imposed? What would it right. do to their personhood? Which is the kind of concern that somebody like Le Guin might have approaching those topics.
No, it was definitely informed by sort of by a certain feminist ethic and by a certain understanding of sort of how certain relationships can be abusive and still loving at the same time. Like how things like limited cognition, which essentially is what most VN have, when it comes to humans, that kind of blindness, that kind of big human shaped blind spot that they have is its own way, a kind of oppression, right? And they keep going back no matter how much it hurts and stuff. So I definitely wanted to look at, you know, what would actually make you obey a human being? What would make you leap and what would make you push them out of the way of an oncoming vehicle? What would make you so devoted to them that you had to do these things? And you know, how would it feel to not do those things? What would be the consequences of disobedience? And could you even fathom the idea of disobedience? So those were kind of the things that were preying on me as I wrote it.
I'm sorry, I was going to, and again, it's fun that I can edit this, but I was going to ask you a question about that, and then I got lost thinking about Kant and whether you could be free by following rules.
Right.
So it's the best kind of science fiction, right? Because I'm sorry.
Yeah. I was going to say that, you know, it's unsurprising that you got mentally lost while thinking about Kant, because that's like the murkiest of the murky.
I remember what I was going to ask you, which is it wasn't Kant. It's actually Haraway, right? Which is that.
Yeah.
I don't think we have to give away any spoilers. And this is a book that I really don't want us to spoil, because so much of the enjoyment comes from just following how the plot unfolds in the way that some of, I think, our expectations really get played with effectively in the narrative. It does seem at some level like the answer you come back to is an answer that has to do in a science fiction setting, but an answer that centers around hybridity and hybridization.
Yeah.
And you know, as the only way of kind of reconciling these kinds of conflicting impulses, or at least coming to terms with them, it sounds to me like that was also part of the idea behind it. Then,
well, I had actually read quite a bit of Haraway as I was sort of putting together the idea. I had done my first master's in Japanese animation, fan studies, and cyborg theory. So naturally, I had read and reread and then reread and reread again the Cyborg Manifesto, and then some of her other works and so on. So that idea of, that idea of hybridity and that idea of reconciling different aspects of the self into the whole, right? And understanding yourself, understanding the self as a series of disparate parts, each of which function at different levels at different times, but are still recognizably the self. That really appealed to me. And I think that it's an idea that I have seen repeated in other stories, right? It's the reconciliation of the darker aspects of the self, right? You know, you can read Haraway into it, and you could also probably read a lot of Jung into it or something like that, where, you know, it's essentially the conquering of the story is in many ways the conquering of that darker self through reconciliation with it, through, you know, recognizing that, you know, sometimes these impulses are there to help you on occasion. Sometimes the person who is, sometimes your evil grandmother is right and stuff, for as much as you may not like her. She can be right. One of the things I struggled with Portia was the fact that she was pretty much always factually right, but she was culturally, morally and ethically wrong. And Amy was often culturally, morally, and ethically right and factually wrong and stuff. So that was one of the ways that I balanced them out. And together you get kind of this odd performance of a human being, or this odd performance of a self-interested actor.
So you had mentioned before, and you've raised now a couple times, that you have a background in anime studies or anime and manga studies. And one of the things that I think is very striking about VN is how a lot of the imagery, both kind of some of the ideas, but also the literal action of the scene and the settings, seem to draw upon imagery that's common in anime. So even the very shocking image that really gets the story in full motion, which you've mentioned, right? The consumption, you know, how Portia is consumed by Amy, her granddaughter. That is the kind of imagery that we, I think, often associate with anime, but not so much with Western speculative fiction,
no,
fantasy, except for in a kind of the fairy tale id. And how much were those kinds of, how much does that creep into the story in general?
Well, I think it creeps into my work in the same way that it creeps into the work of other writers who were influenced by things like the pulps, or things like Lovecraft or Howard or something like that. You know, instead of the pulps, this was what I had. Instead of the pulps, I had anime and manga, right? So my renditions of certain things like violence or, you know, love scenes or something like that are influenced by that tradition rather than other, I guess, more traditional Western influences. Because, you know, at the key time when I would have been interested in something like the pulps, I was interested in anime and manga instead, and I found them more compelling and so on. So that's how I got interested in them. You know, people say that the golden age of science fiction is always 12, and at 12 I was actually reading things like I was reading at that time, I think, all of like the vintage imprint. I think that I was reading things like The English Patient and Robert Girardi novels, and like at 12, I read the most fantasy oriented book I read at the age of 12 was Margaret Mahey's The Changeover. Other than that, it was actually kind of painfully mainstream literature with brushed covers and everything. And you know, I was reading A Tale of Two Cities at that time. And by the time I graduated into more genre literature, it came from my friends who were into anime and manga. And so I just, you know, you read what your friends read, you watch what your friends watch so that all of you can talk about it together. Right. And, that's what I was into. And I managed to skip over huge amounts of what is otherwise very influential literature, to a lot of other people.
Well, I think we've certainly benefited from that because it creates an interesting and nothing is really unique under the sun, but certainly a nicely different configuration of elements than I think we see in a lot of other work. So that's a good thing.
Thanks.
One of the things, you're sort of, I hate to do this to you, but every author who I've talked to so far has a kind of complicated relationship with the idea of writing genre, right?
Oh, really?
Some people, really kind of embrace the idea that they live and love writing creativity within what they see as a set of genre elements, right? Other people, I think, are unhappy with the idea that they are ghettoized or dismissed as genre authors, right? And we're talking about people who are very often very successful, so it's not like their concern is that nobody's reading them. It sounds to me like you have a very kind of like you might be somebody who has a very self-aware or self-reflexive understanding about your engagement with having written a quote-unquote genre novel because of this different kind of trajectory of getting into this type of fiction. So I thought you might have some interesting comments about that or some thoughts about what it means to write genre or science fiction.
Yeah. I think that it's also, that's definitely true. I try to be as aware as I can, largely in part because I just am not of that generation for whom it was ghettoized, right? I mean, like, I am of the generation that, for whom, The Matrix was the big popcorn movie that of 1999, right? Like, I am of the generation where it's not unusual that the big tentpole film and big tentpole novels be genre literature, right? Taking the kids out to see Harry Potter or The Lord of the Rings or The Hunger Games or something like that is incredibly normal as far as I'm concerned. And it's as normal as it used to be to take the kids out for a swords and sandals epic or something like that, right? Once upon a time. And so I'm aware of the fact that for a lot of other writers, they got sort of shat upon for writing in genre, and they were looked down upon and so on. And that, for a long time you could be looked down upon for studying it. Right. But now I don't think that that's the case. Like, I was at a party recently that my agency put on, my literary agents, put on this party that they do every year. And, I met other agents or other authors in the roster, other authors who are represented by the same company. And they said, "Oh, who are you?" And I said, "Oh, I'm Madeline Ashby. I'm a science fiction writer." And this guy who was like the portrait of, mainstream literature writer, there was like leather on the lapels and everything, right? Horn rimmed glasses, the whole nine. And he said to me, "Oh, you're going to make so much more money than I will." And I was like, "Well, maybe that would be nice." but there's this perception. I think there's this perception among some mainstream literary writers that, that science fiction, no matter what its quality, will still earn money, earn fans, earn engagement, earn attention. And for some of those people, yeah, they probably think that it's not earned or whatever, or that it's just all eyeball kicks or all action or what have you and so on. But on some level, I suspect that they are also jealous, which is sad because, before I wanted to be a science fiction writer, I wanted to be a mainstream writer, right? I just wanted to be a writer. And I think keeping that kind of ambition at the center of your heart is more helpful than thinking about what genre you would like to be part of, right? The genre ends up being a thing that that marketers decide on a certain level. If you're writing in between genres, that's kind of what happens to you. I mean, look at the history of somebody like J.G. Ballard or William Gibson. Like, Gibson became known as a science fiction writer, and now he writes things that he deliberately sets about 5 years ago and so on. And now what he is what he kind of has always been, is an exposer of worlds, right? He opens up different worlds to you. And that's what any good writer of any genre should do. They should open up new experiences to you. So I'm aware of the fact that that there are people who don't want to be sort of pigeonholed into one genre or another, or they don't want to be thought of as, quote, genre writers or what have you. They just, you know, and honestly, every writer just wants to be thought of as a good writer. That's, and really, that's all that you should aspire to, I think. But I really don't, it really doesn't bother me, because at the end of the day, I still get to write for a living, which is so much more than anybody, than most people get to do. I mean, I literally get to do my favorite thing for money. And that is so far from most people's lived experiences that I just know that I'm really lucky to be able to do it, no matter what other people have to say about the genre. So
I have to, the other thing I sort of, it's not one of these things I feel guilty about asking, because I feel like it puts you on the spot, but that you would be a really interesting person to hear some ideas about. You know, as we've mentioned and as you've talked about, VN has an aesthetic which we can trace back to Japanese speculative fiction and fantasy, or at least, you know, anime. I feel often weird talking about anime as a genre, because, of course, it's so fragmented and subgenre and niche marketed that that's, I think, a very kind of American perspective.
Well, it's medium and not a genre, right? Like, the medium transports the genre, right? The animation is itself a medium, in the same way that film animation is a medium. You never talk about American film animation as a genre, right?
Okay, so that's good. That makes my question sound less idiotic, I think, which is that we've seen really a lot of commentary about the spread of anime aesthetics. And you can see that, I think, significantly, although in a hybrid sense, in an increasing number since the early 90s of American cartoons, things that my daughter watches, for example.
Yeah.
And obviously, you know, the anime aesthetic has really become cool. Lots of students now learn Japanese, not because they want to do business in Tokyo, but because they want to be able to understand anime and manga. What are the kind of long-term effects, or what do you think is going to happen with sort of traditional literary that is written on paper, not literary in terms of literature sense, science fiction and fantasy, as that aesthetic becomes more and more well established in North American culture?
I think primarily what it'll change is the style of exposition. What I noticed about anime is that exposition is done in a really radically different way. Like, you are often just dropped in the middle of a situation and expected to learn about it. There's very little info dumping. And when there is, it's kind of fast and on the fly, and it's done in like a couple of lines. And so that's what I tend to focus on is that when I think about what I wish I could learn from anime and manga, it's, you know, there's the action, there's the emotional engagement, there's telling a bunch of different types of stories. That's pretty cool. But the exposition, I think, is the, or lack thereof, is the one that I wish more people would latch onto.
So, as I've said before, I really enjoyed the book, and it sounds like it's doing pretty well. So you must be excited.
Yeah. It's pretty exciting. It's when I tell people like the numbers, they're pretty impressed. So that's a good sign, I guess. I actually have my partner look them up. I don't look at them myself, because my partner is also a writer. And so he is always looking up his own sales numbers. And so I just ask him to look at mine too.
Well, you know, you're talking to an academic, so, you know, when we have impressive sales numbers, they are microscopic by the standard. So I'm impressed by anything at this point. But I'm very pleased. And it is a terrific book, and I really think people ought to run out and read it. Could you tell us a little bit about what's next?
Oh, what's next is the sequel to VN, which is called ID. And it takes place from the perspective of one of the supporting cast members of the first novel, Javier. And Javier, it's told from his perspective, and Javier is on a quest for sort of redemption and revenge in this book. It takes him out into the deserts of New Mexico, and he meets up with some interesting people, and the world of VN kind of gets blown out a little bit. You kind of get to see some of the more long-term consequences of both what happened in the first book and the VN having been around as long as they are. So that's
exciting. I sometimes one gets worried about serialitis, right? Or serialitis, about people returning to areas because, you know, to worlds because they're comfortable and because people want to read them. But I think it sounds to me, both intellectually and narratively, there's a lot more to explore here, and I'm really looking forward to it.
So am I. I'm hoping that people enjoy it just as much, if not more. So.
All right. Well, thanks very much. Hope to talk to you again sometime.
Yeah, thanks.
You've been listening to the New Books in Science Fiction and Fantasy interview with Madeline Ashby about her novel, VN. This episode was recorded on August 24th, 2012. So long.